All right. So my guest today on the program has been here before. He was on a couple of years ago, and we were talking, and it turns out we're both tennis fans, and we're both tennis players. So I thought, hey, next time you're in town, let's hit a few balls. And he was like, awesome. Now, that hasn't happened, but we are going to do it. It will happen. So no rallies in real life yet. So until that happens, here's a digital rally instead. I'm Alex Green, and this is Stereo Embers, the podcast. Check this out.
She said, love, love, love is everything. I said, okay, guess whatever. She said, what does that mean? I said, nothing. It's just good to have a backup plan. That means you don't got love. I said, maybe I love everyone. She said, that's the same as loving no one. I said, okay, I guess, whatever. I have a dream of a new American language, one with a little bit more Spanish. Some nice harmonies. I have a dream. I have a dream.
That is the music of my guest today on the program, Dan Byrne. Let me tell you a little bit about Dan Byrne. With close to 30 albums under his belt, the Iowa-born Dan Byrne is one of the great Iron Men of rock and roll. I guess, in many ways, he's kind of like the Cal Ripken of modern music. Why? Well, because he keeps showing up with high-quality work. From albums like 50 Eggs to the newly remastered New American Language, Byrne is one of the very best we have. His music is observational, it's clever, and it's poignant, and it always comes with a melodic center that makes each number he writes more impossible to resist than the last. He's collaborated with Emmylou Harris, he's opened for The Who, written songs for the movie Walk Hard and The Tony Kornheiser Show, authored two books, recorded children's albums, created and hosted two podcasts, and painted countless portraits of sports figures. If you're getting the idea that Dan Byrne is always busy creating things, you're right. Part traditionalist, part punk, Byrne has proven over and over that he's one of the most durable and enduring songwriters on the planet. New American Language, which by the way came out in 2001, has now been issued on vinyl for the first time. He has a new album coming out. Tons happening in the Byrne camp. The guy is super productive. I feel lucky we were able to get him to sit still and have this chat with us. So here you go, me and Dan Byrne having a conversation right here on Stereo Embers, the podcast.
Novak Sinner feels like a final too.
It does, and I think Sinner is looking pretty dominating this whole no one's touched him so far.
You think he's gonna beat Novak?
I do.
Wow.
And what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I've been following it, but because I'm moving around and such, I really haven't seen it, so I don't have a sense of it the way you do.
So pivoting from tennis, because I'll just keep going, I'll drag you into a weird conversation about like arcane tennis facts, but New American Language. It came out in 2001, and now here it is on vinyl for the very first time. And by the way, a very handsome iteration of the album. why did it take so long for this thing to come out on vinyl?
Honestly, I had never even thought about it. And then people were saying, well, Danielle Leshnesky said it should be on vinyl. And then she talked to Grand Phony and they said, yeah, we want to do vinyl. And Mike Viola does vinyl. And, you know, it's funny. I love that it's on vinyl. I love signing them. It's so good. They're so big and there's room to make pictures and big and make the names nice. And of course, when I was a kid, we played records, but you know, I move around and I have my guitar and that's my music. So I don't have that sense and attachment to records that other people have, and I'm glad they do. And I guess that's why I record, but I move on from it so fast. But it's brand new, and it feels cool in a way I didn't anticipate, versus like, you know, making another CD. I don't know, it's a different thing. It's more tangible, maybe. Anyway, I'm real grateful to the people involved.
Yeah, it's really cool. I grew up playing records too. We're about the same age, and I think that, you know, the sort of the tactile satisfaction of the product itself, it's such a nice thing to have, you know.
Opening it up.
Yeah. And you could really study the art, the credits, in a way that I think maybe with CDs that kind of diminished because of the medium.
Yeah, it miniaturizes and minimizes it to the point where, I mean, I didn't really even realize it, but I think I wasn't giving all that much credence to my own work because it was immediately always minimized. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're saying that, like, even for the artist, because we always think about it in terms of the consumer, but and the fan. But even for the artist, you were saying you didn't even think in terms of albums, vinyl anymore either.
Imagine a writer, a novelist, who writes and writes and writes and writes, you know, drafts and drafts and drafts, and then it's finally finished. Maybe it's even got illustrations. And imagine it's simply an ebook, you know, versus this thing that you can hold in your hand and turn the pages and sign. It's kind of on that scale in a way.
Yeah, and I think we lose some of the intimacy, I think, also. It doesn't feel as personal because it's so miniaturized, you know.
It's miniaturized, it's plastic, it's, yeah, you know, and nowadays, of course, people don't even know how to play them, you know, or they just use it to put it into digital form quickly and then get rid of it so it doesn't take up space. Anyway, it's cool. I'm real glad of it.
And also, I think now politically, it does seem like the message of that particular album seems, you know, particularly relevant right now.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's politically charged, and the idea of like the new way of thinking, the new American language that we're talking about now, the way that Trump has sort of corroded the lexicon, you know. I mean, at the time, I remember thinking like Bush was the worst thing that ever happened. And now I just, I'm nostalgic. I mean, yeah. Not really, but you know what I mean. But then again, maybe that message is always relevant. Maybe it's not just relevant now. Maybe it's always like it stopped being relevant for 20 years.
It, you know, it was a very much a millennial record, I think. There was a lot of change and a lot of sense of anything can happen and anything can be conceived of, and new ideas and new beginnings and hope and change. And, you know, it was all very charged in a way. And I think a lot of that was in that. And so, yeah, it's not a light, fluffy tome, although some of it is. Honeydew is.
I mean, protest music is interesting to me, but I would have thought maybe if Trump had been president in 1967, it would have given birth to a lot more politically charged music. Or maybe I'm just not seeing it. But I'm surprised that there hasn't been more. I don't know. Is there more? Are you seeing it? Are you hearing it? Are you writing it?
It seems to me that in different times, people who do that kind of thing have to constantly come up with new vocabularies to do it. You know, it doesn't, that whatever somebody might have railed against Agnew isn't going to cut it now. And the rules have changed. And whereas it might have at one point been satirically sufficient to point out hypocrisies in those upon high, now those same things that might have been useful and could have dented the balloon, seems like things are so much more blatant now, and nobody's even trying to hide anything. So the old solutions of how to respond artistically seems like they haven't applied for a while. And so I think there's a lot of it there. Maybe it just comes in different colors, you know. And also, you know, it's hard to know, like it cuts both ways. That famous Woody quote where it says, my job is to comfort the disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed, you know. There's times when we're all simply disturbed and need to be comforted. There's that too. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a multifaceted time, and we all have to respond in multifaceted ways.
Yeah, if you watch like Saturday Night Live from the 70s, their political satire or their version of the protest song, kind of a protest skit, I mean, it doesn't really hold up, right? It's, I'm sure at the time, anything from Ford falling to whatever was probably really funny at the time. It doesn't really hold up. But there are protest songs, I think, that do, some of them do get sort of stuck in the moment of where they were written. Some transcend it. I don't know if that's the responsibility of the artist to even think about that. It probably isn't. But you're right about the new language and a new way of contextualizing what's happening in the current moment.
Maybe it's simply not, you know, to say something's a protest song means that something else isn't, you know, there's this divide, and maybe it's not even that cut and dried, or, you know, maybe there's songs that have elements of something that also has elements of something else.
Like Straight Outta Compton to me is a protest album as much as any Phil Oakes song, right?
Politically charged. In a way, sometimes I think to call something a protest song means limiting it. But there's another way that all kinds of music is protest music, you know? You could look at the entire Beatles canon and decide that that's protest music. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not protest music in the way of Phil Oakes, but it galvanized people who might, because of it, be tempted to go along with a coast-to-coast showing of hand-holding for the climate, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I've always felt that the political is the personal, and the personal is the political. And so for me, I've never put a hard and fast I don't put them in separate categories. Mm. If other people want to, that's fine, but for myself, I don't.
Is there a subject matter that you just, it doesn't feel good to cover in songs? Like, would you, or do you think anything's fair game?
I think anything's fair game. It depends how you approach it, how you use it. There's things that are certainly offensive, and you know, a lot of that is relative, I guess. But there's a lot of things there's tons of things I wouldn't put into song, but that's just because I don't want to be singing that. But there's nothing that I would say, oh, that's in and of itself off limits. Depends on the who it's for too, and what you want to do with it and all that.
I heard Lewis Black saying that we're in America now, there's two different realities that are being floated. And if you wrote like a really great anti-Trump song, which seems pretty low-hanging fruit, right? It seems like it would be a, you know, like it's ripe and ready to go. It seems like even if you were playing it here in the Bay Area or somewhere in Portland, there's that weird risk of, and maybe who cares, but there's that risk of, you know, half the audience getting upset by that, because the demarcation now of those two different realities has pervaded even the most liberal of cities. I've noticed someone like Taylor Swift seems like really wisely not chiming in, because she'd lose half her audience either way. Is that something that you think about, or is it better to not think about that?
Well, I think you got to pick your spots. And, you know, it's like, yeah, it's all very, very subtle degrees of this or that. I mean, if you're going to sing songs that will just be for people who already agree with you, and that's all it's going to be, I mean, maybe that's there were times when I felt like these songs, like when I put out in 04, I put out it was called My Country 2, and it was subtitled Songs to Beat Bush By. And I imagined people in an election office listening to it when they were working long hours and tired, and they would listen to this and find some energy and, you know, carry on in there. So that was, you know, but right, I don't know. Right now, I don't know. In a way, I think what I'm trying to do with stuff I'm writing now tends to try to, instead of like, if these are, you know, those little IQ games, and like sometimes the answer is not to work within these lines, but you have to go outside these lines in order to solve the thing. I guess I'm sort of looking at it like that. Like, I don't necessarily want to be fighting us against them situation. I'm looking for something that might raise consciousness to the degree that everybody might go, oh yeah, right, we're all brothers, we're all connected, and we need to do this, which I think is harder maybe and more useful. But what else, unless you're simply just writing, you know, a love song, what else, if that's the kind of song you're writing, or that's the kind of art you want to make, that seems like that's what you would be trying to do.
Is that a new angle for you, or has that always been sort of the way you've liked to do it?
I think it's along the continuum. I think I've always tried to do that, but maybe right now I'm more conscious of it. Maybe.
I think because we grew up in a time where it seemed to me like if you went to a Smith show in 1984, this probably wasn't true, but it felt like we were all on the same political page, you know, or a Billy Bragg show or a whatever it was. Music felt like it was so tribal back then. You know, the 80s, the 70s, even the early part of the 90s. And somewhere that I don't think that's true anymore. And there's a part of me that thinks that's probably good. And there's a part of me that's a little bit nostalgic for being in a room where you romanticize the idea that you're all on the same page, which probably, again, wasn't even really true. But maybe close.
Well, maybe we are as humans. We're so tribal and thinking division so much that it's hard to have that feeling in that sense. But maybe when we go hear music or a great play or some communal event, you know, I mean, that's probably why people go to Wrigley Field and all wear the same colors and cheer for the good guys. You know, it's this tribal thing that we're all on the same side and we feel alike.
Yeah, which feels good.
It does.
I mean, I imagine that's why people, you know, go to synagogue or go to church or go to, you know, a Bon Jovi concert. It's probably just the same thing, just to feel that community.
But both ways too. And it can become anytime there's a great crowd, they can be swayed in over to the dark forces too. We've seen plenty of that. And that feels good too, I'm sure. You know, common hate. There's get off on it.
Yeah,
we all think
that's true.
Okay,
we've seen that.
We've seen that. We're seeing that now.
There is that momentum switch where sometimes I'll watch old McEnroe clips, and there's that momentum switch where people are on his side, and then he does something horrible, like, you know, swat those glasses that shatter in front of the King of Sweden or something. And you can feel everybody just switch on him. And it's amazing how that sort of that momentum can go either way. I wonder sometimes if you're playing, right?
That's theater. And he's playing some dark Shakespearean character. And I think he's doing great. Great service in that respect. It may have not been great for him personally, but I think it allowed, you know, the assembled. It's just theater. It's incredible. These surges of emotion that, you know, and again, this is a temp, and it's not, you know, those same dark impulses. In another sphere, I suppose, could have resulted in the deaths of thousands. But it was theater.
Last night I built a bonfire in the kitchen sink. I burned my driver's license and my social security card. Leave my car. drive my car, clean it and sell it to someone else. Eventually they'll unlock my apartment, clean it and rent it to someone else. Eventually the letters will stop coming. Eventually the telephone will stop ringing. Eventually people will forgive me. Eventually people will forget me. I'm gonna move to Europe. I'm gonna leave my girlfriend. I'm gonna change my name. I'm starting over.
Here's an idea I had. Imagine if, because McEnroe's still at an age where he seems to still play very well, right? And he's healthy, and there's a lot of people who would love to. Can you imagine like 1,000 people around the world, millionaires, money to burn, 1,000 people each pay $1 million? That's $1 billion, by the way. And so you've raised $1 billion. McEnroe has raised $1 billion to be used for any great cause he deems fit. Could be $100 million for American tennis. It could be for Doctors Without Borders, you know, whatever. $1 billion. And each one of, and then they draw one name and they get, and it's on TV, they get, or maybe three of them, they get a set. They get to play a set against Johnny Mack. They get 30 a game, so it's 30 love every game. A set with Johnny Mack played at Ash on TV, the ad revenue. If you beat him, and if it's $1 billion, if it's less, it's less. But maybe first time around, you raise $20 million. How great is that? Anyway, it's like if you beat him, then you get like, you know, $1 million. And if he wins, he gets $1 million in his pocket. The rest is for charity. Isn't that great? Wouldn't everybody love that?
It's a brilliant idea. Yeah.
Play a set against Johnny Mack. They would get 10 million viewers. 30 love. You got 30 love. Yeah.
So one set, spot them 30 love each game.
Each game, 30 love. Love 30, he's serving. Love 30. 15-30, okay, you're up 1-0. My serve, 30 love, and so on.
I would totally watch that.
And like, you know, imagine if it, you got a pretty decent player, right? And you're up 30 love, and you're going for it. Maybe it would actually be, you know, competitive 4-3, and then you're watching fucking Mac trying to win $1 million. He's going for it, and he would feel about what he was able to. You know, he'd be like Gandhi. He raised $1 billion for South African aid or something.
And he would do it in an hour.
Yeah. And he wouldn't, he would just have to agree to do it. That's all he would have to do. He shows up at Ash and ESPN's there, the tennis channel. You've made $1 billion for, you present them the check. And then here's, you know, Billy Francis from Cincinnati. And he's got a headband on and he's ready and spin the racket and play.
And if Billy Francis can hit a ball, it becomes even more compelling.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, maybe like a millionaire sponsors, you know, the local tennis hotshot. Maybe you do it that way. I don't know. That could be. But it seems, you know, even though he's been out of the top pro game for 30 years, he's still, I would say, I mean, there's Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic, but after that, he's probably still the most recognizable player in the world and the one most people identify with. He stayed in the public eye. He's still a good player. It's like, shit, man. what an incredible, even if you just did it once, what an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And there's actually, I'd say there's probably five or six players that could probably do something like that. Federer being the other one. And maybe, you know, when Nadal retires and you got him.
I guess you could get Borg to do it.
Why not? Yeah.
Just raise a shit ton of money, have it on TV, and move on with your life.
It'd be a lot better to, I'd rather watch that than pickleball.
Oh, fuck yeah. And I would rather watch that than, if I'm a casual fan, I would rather watch that than almost any tennis that's on now. It's like, pageantry-wise, it would rival Riggs King. Because it's even better. It's, in effect, it's you getting to play the Walter Mitty fantasy of playing McEnroe. It's like, yeah, it's you. And you couldn't do that in really any other sport, but you could do it in tennis. As we're saying it, I know a guy goes way back, and he's like kind of a big wig at Tennis Channel. I guess he should be my... I should talk to him about it.
There's your guy. Maybe he can make it happen. I'm sure McEnroe would like to do something positive for the world. Why not?
So if you get them first to say that they will televise it, and then you get Johnny Mac to say, okay, I'll do it, then you figure out how to sell these. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it should be, but you want to raise $1 billion. Maybe it should be, I don't know, maybe the amounts should be smaller, and you should try to get just thousands and thousands of people to give it a try.
The buy-in could be smaller, get more people.
People. Well, somebody else can figure that out better than me.
I think you figured out the hard part. I mean, that is, it's a really great idea. It's a very fresh idea. And from a viewer standpoint, very compelling.
Yeah. Because it's, you know, there's all these reality shows, so-called, but they're still voyeuristic. This would be a chance. It's like the Willy Wonka golden ticket almost. It's a chance for you, anybody, to step into this fantasy world and be across the net from McEnroe at Arthur Ashe Stadium with TV cameras and money on the line. It's never been done.
No, and for a good cause, even better.
For the greatest cause you can imagine. That's why he would do it, I think.
That's the hook, is that it's the altruism of it.
The enormous altruism. Because, yeah, you know, I see him raising, you know, these amounts for charity, you know. In the realm of the way the world is now, where like a big time sports and like what the Mets sell for, you know, or what the Cowboys are worth, you know, we're talking billions and billions. If you could raise a fucking billion for something good for the climate, you know, or for hunger or for education, and some sick money and spread it around because of this one stunt that you agreed to that everybody, I don't know, man, I think it'd be cool.
I think it'd be awesome. I was looking at what the Dodgers did with Ohtani and Yamamoto, the two guys, it's over $1 billion for two men.
Yeah.
So that, and you know, there's no good cause there, just the Dodgers and their own personal gain. There's no altruism baked into that.
You know, it's like, yeah, it's like bottom-up money instead of top-down money.
Yeah, well, if you have a friend at the Tennis Channel, that's a phone call to make.
That is.
Are you playing a lot of tennis lately? Is that still your form of exercise?
Yeah, I mean, not when I'm on the road in the winter, but when I'm at home, I was playing probably three times a week. And when I'm on the road in the nicer temperatures, I get out and even hit on the wall or something. How about you?
Yeah, the wall has been primarily my, I don't think I could do a treadmill in a gym. I think it would bore me to death. So I just do, I go against the wall and I pretend that I'm playing Djokovic or McEnroe and I just rotate around like that. So, you know, and I think whatever city you're in, I imagine you could probably find a backboard, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we get back down like around Louisville, Oklahoma, I'll probably do some hitting.
I know you're going to Canada. That might be a little trickier right now.
Yeah. I have a, man, I have a tennis musical that I want to unleash on the world soon. It's very cool.
What's the premise?
The premise is, it's called Two Hand Backhand. And it's a two-person play. Think Abbott and Costello meets Waiting for Godot. Fun, snappy dialogue with great songs woven in. And the two characters are the left hand and the right hand. The right hand is extolling the virtues of the one-hand backhand and thinks that they should stay with that. The left hand is on the side of the two-hander and driving the boat on this side. And so for 35 minutes, that's the main argument.
Two characters?
Yeah.
So very much in the spirit of Godot.
Yes. It's, in fact, the funny thing, I found out that a two-person play in theater parlance is called a two-hander.
No way. So,
like, perfect.
So like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, that's a two-person play, right? So that's a two-hander.
That's a two-hander.
And so is there an existential kind of crisis that kind of builds?
Oh, yeah. It's shot through it. But, they come to a place of harmony. That's the whole. And, you know, I think you come out of it with a much changed sense of your own left-right balance. But yeah, they both have their own characteristics. I really want to do it at the Hall of Fame, at the Tennis Hall of Fame. I've got, you know, as a backdrop, 70 tennis portraits too that I've done. But yeah, I imagine just taking over a corner at there or at the tennis tournaments, you know, and like running this thing several times through the day.
Have your portraits ever made it into the hands of any of the players?
I don't think so. I have a couple pictures of Herbert Hoover and his wife that are in the Hoover Memorial, the Presidential Library in Iowa, and what's the other one? Oh, I did one of Bobby Feller that's at the Bobby Feller Museum. But mostly I've hung on to them so I can do a big spread.
But for the musical, what a perfect backdrop to have all those paintings as the perfect. Yeah. I love that you have a tennis musical in the holster.
I'll send you an audio if you want to hear it.
Totally.
Love you to hear it. We got a hit, man.
We got a hit. Are you California bound in I know this is mostly an East Coast thing, right?
Yeah, I did a whole West Coast run in October. I'll get out there eventually. You know, the other thing is I live in New Mexico and I have so much LA people and business sometimes and whatnot. So I'll get out there and then I can get up your way and we can hit.
We'll hit some. It seems like the Bay Area has always been kind of good to you, right? It's been a good place for your good fans here for you.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
I saw you at Slim's, which is no longer a club that exists. Remember that club? Boss Gags owned it.
I remember it well. A great club.
Great club. Yeah. Great club. Had that strange pole in the front. which is weird, but it was, I saw great shows there. I saw you play there and it was just like fantastic.
There and 12 Galaxies, remember that?
Man.
Yeah. I had a whole summer residency, a couple summers, and I'd play there every week or twice a week, and they just gave me Giants tickets all summer. Best.
Did you go?
Oh, every chance I could. I went to every game that while I was there, I think. Yeah.
Not an easy ticket to get. It's a, you know, that's a nice thing.
They were hooked in, and there was the man, it was great.
How are you doing in terms of creatively? Are you sort of in the pocket of, are you on fire with creating and writing songs? Are you feeling especially potent these days? Or,
well, yeah. I mean, I don't know if more than other times, but I've got all these different bands I'm playing with and all these different projects and tons of songs and a lot of touring. I don't know. I hope it doesn't stop anytime soon.
Who are the bands? I don't know about this.
Well, I did a tour on the West Coast with a band that I started with my friend Orit Shimoni and Adam Bush and Paul Kuhn called the Needles Pop Group. And we put out a record called Needlequake on a Spanish punk label. And so we did this run up the West Coast in October. It was amazing. And then I just did these three shows with the IJBC because of the release of New American. And right now I'm doing a bunch of shows with this other band out of Boston called Jane's Great Dane that we made the Starting Over record together. So it's just like from one to the other and hardly a breath and different players and different material and it's like no time to think this is crazy. Just like today we're going here and we're going to be with these people and we're going to sing these songs and you know, I mean, look, there's a lot of times, especially the last few years when we were all sitting around kind of fallow. So I'm not fighting the swirl right now at all.
Do you still love the idea of just being on the road, or when you're on the road, are you like, God, I wish I was home? Are you, in terms of the, you know, sort of the wear and tear of road life, is that still as appealing as it was?
I'm pretty happy being on the road. I'm a, you know, there's so many parts of me that just click into place. So many muscles that like know what to do and what they're supposed to do when I'm doing this. I think a lot of people who do this and who couldn't for those few years are probably feel this way. It seems, what I can tell, seems like people are pretty energized and pretty happy to be able to do this kind of work, you know, at a time when a lot of aspects of this particular thing, this particular form of artistic expression are or seemingly could be easily replaced by machines. This touring bit, this live in front of you bit, seems like one thing that isn't likely to be replaceable anytime soon, unless those holograms get real good. So it's nice to feel the communality.
When you're at home relaxing, is there a party that's like, I got to get to the road? Do you feel like most at home then when you're sort of out there in the world, or can you relax at home? Is that a, can you be in that place?
I'm not sure. Sometimes. But I think lately I've been a little antsy. I mean, I do my things when I'm home. I ride my bike. I play tennis. You know, I cook a lot of rice and vegetables. I can watch the Australian Open. But yeah, I think I've been a little antsy because there's just a lot of things I want to do.
Does New Mexico feel like home now? Does it feel like that's a comfortable place?
Yeah, as much as any place, yeah. I mean, the people I live with and care about mostly are there, so that's a pretty good start.
Yeah, yeah, that's about it. Yeah, I mean, also the climate seems like it's you know, it's like when you're guys of our age, and you know, for me as a, it's weird because I think that as a maybe it's for Jewish guys like us, but I started feeling a draft when I was like 30. I was just cold all the time, you know.
Yeah.
So I would think like New Mexico sounds great because it seems like it'd be really warm, and it would really. I understand now why my grandparents went to Arizona from New York.
For sure, it's like even like I don't know, 40 years ago in Chicago. I think I was like, okay, I don't need to be shoveling this for the rest of my, this is my last winter in Chicago. Yeah, I mean, it's okay once in a while to go see it, but I'm with you.
Yeah, too much cold. I had this girlfriend once, and she was like, "Why do you carry a space heater around everywhere you go? You live in California." And I'm like, "I'm cold all the time. I don't know what to tell you. It's just what I do."
Yeah, and a heating pad's nice too.
Yeah, that might be an addition to the heating arsenal. Well, man, I'm happy to talk to you again. I'm glad you came back on the show, and I do want to hit with you. You know, whenever you come up, you let me know, and we'll hit some balls. You know, At St. Mary's College is where I teach, and you might know our basketball team. We're doing pretty well. But we have a beautiful tennis complex. Two Jewish guys hitting balls at a Catholic college. What could go wrong?
What could be better?
Hey, it's good to talk to you again, Dan.
It was a pleasure. It really was. Great
Thanks,
talking
bud.
To you.
I don't think Dan Byrne and I playing tennis is going to raise money for anything, but it will be fun. Dan Byrne, always so much fun to talk to him. DanByrne.com. I thought I was up on everything he's done. There's like 10 other projects I missed, so I'm catching up. Are you catching up, or are you in the loop on everything he's doing? I'll bet you you're not, because there's a lot. Get in there, dig into the world of Dan Byrne. Again, DanByrne.com is where you need to go to find out all the ways to get acquainted with his body of work. My body of work is much smaller, but check it out anyway. AlexGreenBooks.com is where you need to go to find out what's happening with me. The new novel, The Adventure Teen All-Stars, is out now in paperback. Maybe it's a nice little gift for Easter. Do we give gifts for Easter? Do we do that kind of thing? Maybe that's the move. Put it in the Easter stocking. You can follow me on what's left of Twitter at Embers Editor, or on Instagram at Embers Podcast, or email me editor@StereoEmbersMagazine.com. Check out BombshellRadio.com to find out what makes our radio station tick. And don't forget, Stereo Embers, the podcast, is available on all podcast platforms, including the one you're using right now. Rate and review it if you can. Tell your friends. Spread the word about our show. We appreciate it. Let's close the show with a longer listen to New American Language, the title track from Dan Byrne's 2001 album, which is now available on vinyl. It's a very handsome iteration. It's perfect to put right under the Easter tree. Enjoy it, and thank you as always for listening to Stereo Embers, the podcast, only right here on Bombshell Radio.
She said, love, love, love is everything. I said, okay, guess whatever. She said, what does that mean? I said, nothing. It's just good to have a backup plan. That means you don't got love. I said, maybe I love everyone. She said, that's the same as loving no one. I said, okay, I guess, whatever. I have a dream of a new American language, one with a little bit more Spanish. Some nice harmonies. I have a dream. I have a dream. Tourist towns are a drag sometimes, but in non-tourist towns you can get beat up just for looking a little different. I guess the thing to do is just stay at home. Yeah, but sometimes I think the thing to do would be to get a place way out in Missouri, put down as many months' rent as you can part with, tell everybody else you went to France. Saturation vibing.